Hi, everyone. I'm Ina Fried with All Things Digital. I'm here with Mark Bertolini, who's the CEO of Aetna, and we're either talking about hockey or wireless and healthcare and technology and how it's transforming healthcare. So we'll see how that goes. Thanks, everyone. So in addition to both being big hockey fans, both Mark and I are passionate about the idea of technology and healthcare and the different ways in which that's interacting. And it's a really complex interaction. I mean, I think a lot of people start out by looking at the ways in which technology has transformed our healthcare broadly over the last many years and changed society from one where there was a lot of manual labor, a lot of exercise, a lot of urban living, to one with suburban living, a lot of automation, and, you know, trace the obesity crisis and all that stuff. How realistic is the role of technology in where we find ourselves on the negative side health-wise today?
I think you point out that the sedentary lifestyle, you know, suburbanization of our lifestyles and the use of technology has caused us to use less exercise and to be talked to all day long about the things we should eat, which has affected our diet, increased obesity. And if we look at our populations that we manage around the world, obesity is the number one threat to healthcare costs, and healthcare costs are the number one threat to the economic condition of most nations now. And so if you think about that in and itself as a silo, you have another alternative impact, which is that medical clinical technology has advanced so far, including public health, which has had the biggest impact, that life expectancy has expanded. But what we're seeing right now are those lines are crossing, where the sedentary lifestyle, obesity, et cetera, is now causing lifestyles to shorten. And I think the next step is how do we use technology to engage people, to change behavior, in order for them then to get better, healthier, and to live longer.
So that's obviously the context of what we're going to be talking about is, right, given that overarching thing, what role does technology have to play? And I want to take a step back, though. You have a real passion for healthcare and technology, and I think you have an interesting story of how that came to be. Do you want to explain to folks a little bit how
Sure.
you came to be interested
so
in this?
So in 2001, my son was diagnosed with cancer, and when I was searching for a solution for his cancer, it became very apparent that information was a very limited access to patients. And so what we did is we moved into the hospital room with a Harrison Internal Medicine text, which, you know, has probably on its 100th edition, and a laptop computer to try and find out the latest on his condition versus taking him from doctor to doctor to doctor looking for somebody who would have a solution. And it was at that point and through that journey and being with Eric as he fought his cancer that it became very apparent to me that you could not advocate for your loved one or for yourself effectively without good access to information, and that the healthcare system, while it had great medical technology, had very little information technology to allow people to make good decisions. And it was at that point that I started formulating how I could make changes in the healthcare system, and that's what Aetna is in large part about, is using the bully pulpit and the $34 billion in revenue we generate every year and the billions of dollars worth of cash flow to change the healthcare system to make it work for the individual versus having it work for the system.
And obviously that's gone from laptops a few years ago onto our smartphones. I want to kind of break down the impact that these mobile devices are having on healthcare into a couple of different categories, because I think they're impacting different populations really differently. One is like you're talking about with your son, so people with severe illness, perhaps rarer illness, you know, where literally, you know, it wasn't that long ago that if you had a rare disease or a severe disease, you would, you know, spend a lot of time traveling across the country to find, you know, that one doctor who specializes it. Maybe let's start there. How has technology transformed the treatment and care? And you've seen this both as a father, but also, you know, as a company that has to deal with members who are in these severe illnesses. How has technology and mobile technology transformed the way the very sick and those with rare diseases are treated?
Well, here's a way to think about it. If I have a significant issue, there is now enough information out there on the internet for me to get better informed than the physician I'm about to see about my condition when I go see my doctor. Physicians are overwhelmed with information today. If a physician read two periodical articles a night, every year, every night for a year, they'd be 400 years behind in the current medical literature. So their ability to get informed and stay informed on everything going on in the system about everything that could possibly happen to their patients is almost impossible. I would argue impossible. But for a patient who has a specific issue, like my son's T-cell lymphoma, you can learn an awful lot today out there on the internet with the information available. So you find a patient coming almost better prepared in a lot of cases to meet the physician with better information. That disconnect is what we're trying to solve for. And so on both sides of that equation, on the provider side, we're trying to arm physicians with technology that sits next to them that allows them to be better informed and up to date, not only on what's going on in the world at large, but about their patients. So that when they meet the patient or the patient interacts with them digitally, that they have a better chance of meeting the needs of that individual and making the transaction efficient and as high as quality as possible, which ultimately results in better costs.
So the second group that I think is probably a fair number of people in this room, certainly the crowd at South by Southwest, young, relatively healthy in many cases, fairly active. There's been a real transformation of how that population can interact. So it's everything from Map My Run to a scale that tweets out your weight to apps that sort of gamify exercise and behavior. How important do you think that trend is, and how powerful is that as a relative force compared to what we talked about at the beginning in terms of sedentary lifestyles, suburbanization, et cetera?
So our healthcare system today is focused on curing illness. And what we should be focused on is making our population healthy and productive. And we view that today in the system as making somebody better from where they were before and making them more productive instead of keeping them productive and healthy all along. The problem is that when you talk to someone about the impacts of diet and exercise on the long-run impact of metabolic syndrome first and then diabetes, it's like, well, you know what, that's 30 years from now. Not a big deal for me. Why should I be concerned? And so finding technologies and ways to reach people that get them engaged now and do the easy things to change behavior is the big search. That's the holy grail, I think, for all of us. And what we've come to a conclusion is that the best way to do that is to make it as easy to use as possible, to make it as accessible in a place where people can get the information that they want when they want it to help them change their behavior. And until we get that right, we're going to continue to have people that are going to put it off until it's too late, and then we're going to have a system that focuses on the cure. So that part has always been, for our industry, a big issue, because when we do everything right in the current system, everybody, we're invisible. It's when we do something wrong that people call us or complain. And so having the best service model means we're no worse than anyone else. Well, that's not a great tagline for your brand.
That's not your new motto. You're not here to launch the new motto. We're no worse than everyone else.
Or we suck less. No, that's not what we're about. I mean, the real issue is what do we do to make ourselves useful to everyone? And the best way to do that is to make it simple, easy to use, convenient, right there when they need it. And that's where the mobile technology revolution and the application environment makes a big difference.
So right now, I see all these really interesting products coming out, whether it's things like Fitbit and Jawbones Up and Nike's doing stuff, or some of these apps that we've talked about that track your running and exercise. Mm-hmm. But right now, what we see is those are apps for the very wealthy, very mobile consumer. They're paying for it out of pocket. I don't think we're going to get too far in this conversation before we talk about reimbursement and payment. Right. When is Aetna and Aetna's peers going to start paying for things that help keep us well?
So I would argue that a lot of that we can offer for free. Because if we offer it for free and people are using the system better and they're staying well, that advantages us in the long run. It requires us to build loyalty with the customers. So a lot of the apps we're developing today, like iTriage, which is an Aetna company now, is a free download. There's over 5 million downloads on the Apple App Store on iTriage alone that's free, completely free. And it accesses your medical records and allows you to make schedules appointments and to select the right kind of doctors that meet your needs. So our whole goal is, in a lot of instances, here's a piece of technology, use it. Now, the real issue for us is, how do we get them to use it? And so you talk about all these apps that exist out there in the app world. The problem is that you've got to fit them all together into different pieces. So I got to use this one for my running. I use this one for my diet and fitness, my weight control. I use this one for my doctor or my personal health record. I store my information over here. And what we've developed with the CarePass system is a platform now, which we launched Monday in New York, where you can put all of this stuff together and it interacts. And this came to me in a about 3 years ago. I was shopping for a sweater my daughter had to have for Christmas. So I'm at Macy's at the rack where I could find the sweater. I find the sweater and I take out my Droid and I barcode scan it. Google Shopper pops up. I push on Google Shopper. It gives me the stores around me that have the same sweater and the price points. I push on the cheapest one. Google Maps pops up. And so I get directions.
Is there going to be a barcode on my doctor? Can I scan him?
Maybe on you.
It's going to be cheaper.
Maybe on you. And so, you know, I could get my sweater. I found out how to get that sweater in 3 minutes. So I took the whole thing to work and I said, I want this.
So what does that look like in the healthcare context? Because I'm not really...
I'm on my way home from work and I haven't had my flu shot yet. And instead of spending an hour on the phone trying to get a flu shot appointment, taking a morning off of work, queuing up at some hospital to meet a nurse while other sick people are waiting around the waiting room to get my flu shot, I push on an app, which we're calling, it's sort of like Open Table for medical care, and I can get my flu shot on the way home. Where can I get a flu shot on the way home from work? Blinking blue dots on the screen, push one, book it, get it on the way home from work. Redefining quality for most of us is convenience.
How far do you think we are from the time, you know, right now, a lot of us go to the doctor when we have a cold. You know, we don't have that greater relationship with our doctor to begin with. We don't go that often because of all the things involved. You talk about getting the nearest flu shot. You know, what I'd like is, you know, for the doctor's schedules to be interactive so that I can say, you know what, I have a sore throat. I just want to see a doctor that I don't have to pay out of pocket for and has availability today. Is that something you guys are looking into?
Well, we can do it in China right now. We've launched an app in China where you can find a doctor, book an appointment, and when you're done with your appointment, submit your claim form.
It's a little further than I was hoping to go.
But you like to see the world. I know you're a world traveler, so you may want to think about that. No, our new CarePass platform does that.
And you talk about China, and one of the things that I think is really important to this context, I mean, when we talk about these apps, we're talking about a fraction of the U.S. population. Even when we talk about the U.S. population, we're talking about a doctor-patient model, maybe a nurse-patient model that we're very used to in the U.S. This doesn't scale globally, right? There's entire populations being born right now that will never see a doctor.
Well, the patient-physician relationship, as we know it in the United States, doesn't scale. Because you don't have that many physicians around the world to take care of the people that are coming out of the rural environments into urban situations. For the Chinese, their first savings priority is education. Their second is healthcare. They have to pay for most of it out of their pocket. So for them, getting access to a physician is far more important than whether or not my physician's in my network, which is how we think about it today. But back to the point you made earlier, if you go to the CarePass platform today, you can download it free off of the Aetna App Store, Apple App Store. You can make doctor appointments, have it link into your calendar and set up a reminder, link your personal health record to it today. Now, we're not that connected with every physician office because we're not connected with all the scheduling systems yet, but we will be. Once you have the app in place and people start using it, as you know, it creates this network effect where people need to get on it because that's the best way to get patients.
And I want to come pretty quickly back to the U.S. because I think that's where a lot of people's interests lie. But I do want to talk a little bit about globally because I think the transformation is by necessity happening faster in other places.
It is.
And it's also more radical in that smartphones are bringing a bunch of things in rural and developing countries that they haven't ever had before, whether that's connectivity to the internet, it's got a camera. How much of this vision that we hear talked about is actually happening where somebody in a village gets sick, the one person with a camera smartphone, you know, connects them, whether it's by messaging or, you know, video or pictures to a doctor remotely and they're getting the healthcare they need?
I think that's a dream right now. I don't think that happens an awful lot. It may happen in a few rare instances, but it's not far away. Because that technology is all the technology those people have. And so it's easy for us. And by the way, access to healthcare and affordability of healthcare is not just a U.S. problem. It's a global problem.
Are there countries that are getting it right when it comes to payment? Because I don't want to spend the whole time talking about payment, but I don't think we get very far without without looking at the fact that we have, at least the largest parts of the U.S. healthcare system are, the public parts pay when you have a certain service.
Right.
And with very few exceptions like Kaiser or something where, there it's a self-contained unit, you are not delivering the same person delivering it isn't paying. All that's a bunch of mumbo jumbo to a lot of people, but what it means is that in general, folks that are paying for it pay for a particular service. Are there countries where they really are paying for wellness, and how different do they look? Developed countries.
There are a lot of countries that have a bunch of different models around payment. Nobody really has solve the payment, the incentive alignment problem at the physician level. Most socialized nations, where they're budgeted at the government level, their capacity is defined by their government budget. And physicians and hospitals are paid on a salary basis or on a budgeted basis, cost plus basis. What we really need to get to is a population management sort of model, which is where we're trying to move here in the United States, where we say for this defined population with this level of illness burden and this level of wellness, here are all the things that we could invest in to improve the level of wellness and to eliminate the illness burden in this community. And pay everybody in the system on achieving those goals versus on the number of procedures they did.
And what are the biggest steps towards getting there? Because I think everyone who looks at the system says, yep, that's great, that's where we want to be.
Right.
I don't hear anyone talking about, here's a clear pathway there. What are some of the key things that need to happen to make that occur?
So in the 90s, we had this thing called capitation, where we would pay physicians so much a month to take care of their population, including referrals to specialists and hospitalizations.
So basically paying a doctor for each person they take care of.
A fixed fee, right, a fixed fee. Didn't work. Because what we sent them was a green bar report about this thick with the patient's name, their social security number, their patient ID number, their member number, and a capitation amount. And then under the rubber band that held it all together, we slipped a check. And that's all the information they had. And they went bankrupt with it. A lot of physicians. And health plans went bankrupt because they had to pick up the bill. The big difference now is creating a technology platform that allows them to see a 360-degree view of the member, to make the system about the member, so they see everything that's going on. And that's what's all this work on health information exchanges and clinical applications, what they call meaningful use applications, is all about.
And to bring this to real-world terms again, basically today, for most health plans, let's not pick on Aetna, but most health plans will pay my doctor if I go in and see them a certain amount.
Right.
They will not pay my doctor if he answers my question by email, even though that saved us both a ton of time.
Right.
Many doctors are doing that, but it's almost despite the system instead of, wow, that's a much more efficient way of handling a simple thing.
So we need to change the payment model. We call it payment reform, global payments, which really is the new word for capitation because capitation has such a dirty connotation associated with it.
It doesn't sound real good. It's too close to decapitation.
Yeah, that's true. I never liked the word anyway. And so, it's really about global payments. And if we pay that way, then all of those things, I would argue you wouldn't even need benefit plan designs. I would argue where you're really doing true population management and we're reimbursing the system on improving the productivity and health of the community that they're serving, that we could ultimately get to a point where if they needed a taxi ride to get an office visit, that'd be a good thing. Or if a new mother needed diapers for a while because she couldn't afford them, that would be a good thing. We used to call those social HMOs back in the 70s. There's one left in the United States. It's called the Scan Health Plan in San Diego. But that's the model we ultimately want to move to.
So there's these great ideas that I think we could all come up with. I think if I asked anyone here, we could come up with 10 things that cost a little bit now and save a ton of money in the long run.
Exactly.
Many of those are not covered today. Now, I want people to understand why. It's not because you don't get it. One of the issues today is an Aetna member today may not be an Aetna member 5 or 10 or 15 years from now. So you fiscally, it's hard to make investments that will only pay off over a 20-year time frame, right?
I think even for some employers, right, where they turn over their total employee population every 2 years.
So we have two issues. People change jobs more frequently than that, and they change health plans.
Right.
What time horizon, when you're looking at the numbers, over what time horizon does an investment have to save? You know, if you're going to spend a dollar now to save over the long term, how long a horizon can you afford to amortize that?
I mean, it varies across the board. So technology like our active health system, which looks for omissions and commissions of care in all the data that we get every day, that gives us an 8-to-1 return immediately. So we put that across all of our members. Our personal health record, we launched across all of our members. Complete access to all of their data. Interestingly, only 10% of them ever really look at it, even though they have a username and a passcode. But that information, that kind of investment for us is a no-brainer. Let's do it now.
Even when you change members, they still benefit. I'm looking more at the investment in an individual member.
Right.
If you're going to invest a dollar in wellness, how much does that have to save and over what period of time today, under today's healthcare system, to make that pay off?
So, again, it depends. So, if we're talking about diabetes, it's a long-run investment. It's 20 years to prevent somebody from getting diabetes. But the cost of educating them now to eat right and stay fit is relatively cheap if they'll pay attention to it. So the cost-benefit analysis is there if we can make the right investment now in getting people engaged now.
But a gym membership, for example, in theory, would save cost over the lifetime, would save healthcare costs, right? I don't know very many healthcare providers, and I struggle to think of any off the top of my head that'll pay for your gym membership.
No, they don't.
Why not?
How many people use their gym membership?
Well, should we survey two? Yeah, right? I know
my credit card's getting hit every month.
I'm in the same boat.
Right.
Touché.
So the issue is what is the intervention that actually produces results? And can we pay for those now?
Could you, and I'm now brainstorming out loud, but could you offer a discount on healthcare or some sort of incentive for the person that actually checks in at the gym using their app so many times?
It's a great idea. We also have at Best Buy now a $19.99 card you can buy to get apps that are about wellness that's at a discount from the services we offer. In China, we offer a retail app on a mobile phone for wellness for the families of workers in China who have used their program before. So we do those sorts of things. We offer yoga classes to our employees because we know that yoga and mindfulness has a dramatic reduction on their stress. So we have a number of those programs. The problem is that not every person, as you well know, reacts the same to the same kind of input, right? And so we all have our own thing. My wellness and my pain management around my spinal cord injury is directly related to yoga, meditation, Vedic chanting, and cranial sacral therapy. Well, I haven't ever seen a health plan brochure that has any of those in them.
And you use all those, and you haven't added them globally for Aetna either,
we're doing
right?
it now. We're okay. doing the yoga and the meditation piece now because we have found through a bicoastal study that it actually pays off. And it pays off now. And so what we need is more evidence-based results around the things that actually do matter. And instead of just trying them, we actually need to measure them. And where we find immediate results, we've been more than happy to offer them immediately. I'll give you a great example. Most people spend half of their healthcare costs in the last year of their life. And it's because they end up in a hospital with a family member who doesn't know what to do. And so they turn to the medical profession and say, what do you want to do? And the doctor says, well, we can do this, 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 and this. Which one do you want to do? And the member goes, I don't know. And even though a person may have an advanced directive, they still try all of those things. So when Eric was in the hospital, I had to put him in hospice at one point. But I had to admit he was going to die in 6 months and that he could no longer receive curative services. It could only be palliative services. When I got out, Eric graduated from that, and he's actually out in the working world earning money these days. He survived his cancer. But when I got out from that, I said the hospice programs in the United States don't work because of these two issues. So at Aetna, 2 years later, we developed a program where we eliminated the 6 months. We eliminated the need to avoid curative services and to give up on hope, really, which is what we were saying to people. And we tested it for 2 years over our population, and guess what happened? 76% of people died at home versus 24% before.
It turns out that people aren't going into hospice just to take advantage of the free...
Right. Hospital days went down 80%, and costs went down 80%. And people had a better end-of-life experience. So we saved tons and tons of money just on that program alone. So we've launched it across our total population because it makes incredible sense to not say to people, you got to give up hope and you got to admit you're going to die.
So when we look at the health technology universe, particularly the wireless and apps and stuff, what of the stuff do you look at? And obviously, one of the things that's important to you is actually studying it. But what are the areas where you say, yep, we see a ton of promise in there. It's early, but we see a ton of promise. And what are the things that you say, you know what, I think that's more gimmicky. It's like the health, it's like the gym membership that neither of us use. Which, how do you separate those?
Behavior change is the big study we're doing now. How do we get people to do something different? What motivates them to change? And we've studied a lot of people, and there's a guy at Stanford University, BJ Fogg, that's got a big research lab on behavioral change, and we had him come out and spend some time with us. And he had a very interesting argument. His argument was is that the carrot and the stick aren't really all that effective. It is for some people. But it's really about stuff that you can measure and is right in front of you. It's very tangible, very simple to understand. The carrot and the stick can direct you in one way or the other. And quite frankly, that's what the healthcare industry has used for a long time, particularly insurance, around changing behavior, carrot and stick. Or I like to use the frozen carrot. Here's your carrot. If you give it back to me, I'm going to use it as a stick. If you hold on to it, it's good to eat for you. And so the whole notion of carrot and stick really doesn't work anymore.
So it's more this idea that these are a lot of small choices. You know, nobody decides, I'm going to eat great or I'm going to eat badly.
Right.
They make choices one meal at a time.
It's making it easy to change. And his argument is that motivation is far less a predictor of behavior change than the ease of the change itself. And he actually said to our audience, floss one tooth. Because more than half of Americans don't floss their teeth. And they get periodontal disease, which, by the way, leads to cardiac plaque, same plaque on your teeth as in your heart. Also creates insulin sensitivity for people with metabolic syndrome. And so he said, you know what, floss one tooth. And if you fit the flossing of the one tooth into your routine, maybe you'll floss the rest. And so the idea of making it easy to do, and so technology provides that ease. But it isn't easy if you got to go here to get this, and you got to go there to get that. It's got to be integrated. It's got to be a place where you can be, where your health is about you, not about the system. Where it's your data. So, you know, I have my health financial data, I have my you know, my spinal cord injury data, I have my fitness data, I have all the other things, and all of that should be about me, and it should be in a place where I can get it versus me having to search all over the place to find it. So this ease of use, this ease of making the change is really what we're about with the technology revolution that we're trying to push forward in healthcare.
I have a few more questions, but I want folks to start thinking about questions. We are going to have time for audience Q&A, and unless you want it to devolve into a battle over whether the Sharks are better than the Red Wings. It'd be good to come up with some questions. How important, speaking of games, how important is gamification, in your opinion, the idea that social pressure, that if my wellness in some way is either made fun for me or made social, I'll make different choices. Is that just a... I have a feeling we're going to hear a ton about it, but I'm not sure whether it's more fad, more real, or somewhere in the middle.
I think pure gamification has some merit, and it'll be generational. I think the social aspect of it, I think, is huge. And so I would argue that wellness and wellness behavior and wellness communities using social media are going to be far more impactful than these brochures and these phone calls we make to members about their lifestyle, about their eating habits, and about their exercise. So I think social media as a tool is incredibly powerful in creating better wellness and prevention. And so I think that's where we're headed. We're actually experimenting inside our company with social media platforms. We actually now are out on Twitter with @AetnaHelp and @Aetna, and I'm out on Twitter at @MTBERT, and we're using these social media as a way of connecting with people in different ways and offering advice. And guess what? It works.
What about some of these, you know, things like Dennis Crowley, the Foursquare founder? He's always tweeting out his weight. He's got one of those Y things scales.
It's a great idea.
You know, it strikes me though that the person that is struggling with that is probably not going to tweet, but maybe it keeps somebody that's working hard. You know, it adds motivation. Those kinds of things, is it things where people can compete on exercise with their friends?
With our own employees, we have a thing called Get Active Aetna, where our employees form in groups of four. I'm on a team. And we compete on diet and nutrition and on exercise. And we record it every day. And you get so many points, you get, you know, a tchotchke out of a magazine at the end of the program, or you get reward points, actual dollars into your HRA or your HSA account, up to $1,200 per year. And that's a big amount of money, for particularly for our frontline employees. And that whole gamification of that program, holding each other accountable, you know, we got IMing between people to get people to focus on it, has been great for us because our trend has been low single digits for the last 2 years. Our healthcare cost trend. And that's had an impact. Now, we've only had 2/3 of our employees.
Low single digits, meaning your healthcare costs for covering your employees is only going up low single digits.
Like negative last year, and it's like low 1 to low 3%.
That's not what's typical, what we're seeing.
No, it's not. Right. But it's this whole focus as an organization on what we can do to be better fit. So gamification and social media kind of platform really works well.
So again, when we look at the technology in healthcare, there's a set of things that just make sense. Some of them are long-term investments, but they're long-term investments that, like we talked about, pay over the cost of all your members, no matter who they are.
Right.
Things like, you know, making your doctors more efficient, scheduling, those sorts of cost-benefit type things. What are some of the hard choices that you and your industry need to make? We've talked a little bit about what the government needs to do. What are some of the hard choices that the healthcare payers need to make to invest? And what's an example of something that's either a big gamble or a hard choice that you guys are making?
So I think as an industry, we need to decide what's worth doing ourselves versus worth doing together or in a broader community.
Because some of this issue over you can't invest if you don't know if they're going to be your member or somebody else's member.
Right.
If you guys contributed X amount per member per year to a pooled set of wellness things, that would benefit all your members.
So we're looking at things like that. How do we take care of the real sick? How do we take care of the real well? What are the things that we can cooperate on? I mean, should we all be processing claims? I mean, processing a claim's a pretty simple thing. And with the technology available today, shouldn't we be doing that somewhere else?
Simple for you. It's still a pain for me. I still get, but we can, that's a whole nother story. But I still, you know, well, I have you on stage, so I have to ask. How disturbing is it that there's a profession now that is a consultant to help individual healthcare plan members deal with their insurance company?
I think it's,
and workers are providing it as a, employers are providing it as a benefit.
I think it points at the issue of why we've got to change as an industry. Because if you have people trying to navigate the morass, as I call it, if we're that complex to interface with, no wonder people don't like us. No wonder people don't stand up for us as private industry in the American economy when the president attacks us. And so we have to change. And again, that's why we've been making the investments we have. But there are investments as an industry we can make the same way to get at this issue. Because quite frankly, it isn't competitive to do it anyway. It isn't differentiating that we process a claim in 3 days versus seven. Who cares? Just pay the claim.
Yeah, no, I care more about the fact that you reject my claim as a member for idiotic reasons.
And that's the only time you call us. You never call us to say, you know, my doctor called today to say he got paid in 7 days and he really appreciates because it's usually 14. Want me to tell you thanks. We never get those phone calls.
Okay, well,
okay.
I'll end my rant on on healthcare because that could take more time than we have. Do folks have questions? I want to open it up now, and if not, I'll ask
way in the
more.
Back.
Way in the back. All the way back there. Are there microphones or... Excellent. So you need a microphone.
You need a microphone.
There's a few folks, it looks like, with microphones. Do we want people to line up or just raise their hands?
They're in the aisles, right?
Yeah. Oh, they're in the aisles. Well, great.
The microphones are in the aisles.
Feel free to line up in the aisles. Go ahead, sir. Thanks.
My question is, there's been a lot of publicity lately about brain training as it addresses dementia or Alzheimer's and that type of issues. Is this anything that you've investigated or seen value in providing to your members?
So to broaden this out just a bit, you know, with metabolic syndrome and diabetes, it's real clear. If you do things about diet and exercise, you can stave off these problems. With some of these brain things that are affecting a growing number of people, we don't really know. What right. are you guys seeing?
So we have a group of physicians that do nothing but scan the literature. It's a technology assessment group that does nothing but scan the literature and look for ways that we can apply these technologies to our population. And also, quite frankly, to look for ways where it can be misapplied. You know, so for the 64-bit cardiac imaging, I mean, that's way too much radiation for most people. It's available and, you know, it's appropriate in certain instances. So what we try and do is put together what we call coverage policy bulletins that outline our view, which are publicly available on our website under the provider section. They're called, you know, coverage policy bulletins, where we describe these technologies and where we think they're appropriate and where we think they're not appropriate. So depending on the stage of research they're at and how far along, but we monitor this stuff way out in stage one so that we're following it as it comes through. Because if it can help, we're gonna cover it.
So this is the other piece of the technology and healthcare side, which is the question of, you know, historically, we got a lot, our life expectancies have gone up if we take out the metabolic stuff that's changed that, because we had all this great new technology, but that's added enormous cost to the system. How do we make sure we're getting the best of this new technology without creating a healthcare system, which some might argue we already have, that no one can afford?
Well, we already have one of those. So for example, there's a thing called proton beam therapy. Proton beam therapy is very appropriate because, in certain instances, because they're going to attack the exact cancer cell. You can narrow it right down to the cancer cell. So it doesn't have the collateral damage that radiation therapy has or other forms of dealing with cancers. However, it's only effective in certain cases. And we need about 5 to 10 of these centers in the United States to handle all of the cases that we should have. Yet there are 50 applications in place right now, supported by private equity, to build them. Now, what does that matter? Well, you could put a proton beam therapy machine on this end of the stage. The problem is it's powered by a linear accelerator, which requires a building the size of a football stadium. And they cost $160 million apiece.
And once they're built,
right, and once they're built, they're going
to
use them. Right. And so the whole race around technology and healthcare is it's a build it and they shall come approach. Now, if that system was being incented to take care of the health of the population they're serving and being paid that way, they probably wouldn't build that machine, they'd use somebody else's. And so I think that is a big issue today that we battle day in and day out.
Okay, I see we have a lot of questions.
We have a lot of folks lined up.
Go ahead.
My name is Pamela Hernandez, and I'm a personal trainer. And I want to go back to the gym question, because the gym membership alone, you're right, it doesn't do any good. But how can myself and other fitness professionals get into that relationship where we are making sure that people are coming in and doing what they're supposed to do and holding them accountable, almost looking at us like a prescription or another part of that healthcare system? Because unfortunately right now, I know I don't feel like that, and many people in my industry don't feel like that. Like, we
sure.
can't get that relationship and get that treatment, which essentially what it is for things like metabolic syndrome, covered.
So here's my challenge to you. And this is the challenge we have with the yoga thing. There are yoga therapists who go to school for 5,000 hours worth of training and are truly well-trained in how to really use yoga, not just the poses, but pranayama, which is the breathing, you know, asana, the physical poses, and meditation to really impact health of individuals. And then there are people that go away for a 3-day weekend to get a yoga teacher's training certificate. And how do we discriminate between the yoga therapist and the yoga teacher, who's had, you know, 24 hours worth of training? So your profession has to define a set of parameters where we can credential you to say, this type of training and intervention with these kinds of individuals has an impact. And we can test that. Then we can pay you.
So the issue, as you're framing it, is you'll pay for fitness and those kinds of wellness activities if the people are better trained, and clearly, you know, people have to actually be using it. You're not going to write
right.
a $50 a month check to 24-hour
right.
fitness. But, I mean, how ready are you if, you know, somebody commits to, you know, going to the gym once a week? You know, would you pay for a gym that charged per visit? Because then you'd be getting that thing.
It depends on what they're doing in the gym. You know, are they sitting on the exercise cycle, you know, turning the pedals every 3 minutes, reading the paper? So what is the routine? What is the intervention of the trainer involved in that to help that person get into it? And if you think about that, what that becomes over time is physical therapy in a lot of ways, right, which we do reimburse.
And so how close do you think we are to your company, because you can only speak for your company, to right. your company paying for something that represents a good gym with a good trainer?
Well, what we're beginning to do is develop rewards programs where we will reimburse these sorts of things for individuals that do the right behaviors. So what are the right trade-offs? If I do X, Y, and Z, if I present, call it a social contract. If I quit smoking, I agree to keep my weight within certain limits, I take my medication for my hypertension, there's a reward for that. That may be a gym membership. But there needs to be a social contract between the individual and the health plan that says we're going to build a relationship where we're both going to work on making you a better person.
So in general, the consumer, the health consumer, is probably going to have to make the changes, and if they make the changes, they'll get
That's
rewarded.
What we do with our own employees.
Okay. Next.
Welcome to Austin, by the way.
Thank you. Good to be
Thanks
here.
Thanks for the weather. We appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, what no happened problem. To the weather?
Should have been here last week, right?
It was warmer in Hartford this morning.
My name's John Cox, and I really liked your comment about the unscalability of the physician-patient relationship. I was curious what sort of initiatives you guys are taking in similar veins to kind of strengthen and scale the physicians and their ability to do that.
So I think that's all about what we call the patient-centered medical home, and it's an environment where it's about the individual, the patient, getting the right level of service from the right level of practitioner, and that we elevate everyone that works in that setting. And it could be a physician assistant, a clinical nurse practitioner, a doctor, a nurse, even a massage therapist, maybe even a yoga teacher, working in an environment where they're all working together to their highest level of capability in the best interest of the patient. I think that's how we solve the 90,000 doctors we're going to be short over the next decade in taking care of just the American public, let alone all the issues we have around the world. So we need to look at scope of practice across the United States, get everyone practicing to their highest level within a group environment, using technology to get a 360-degree view of the member, and that's what's called the patient-centered medical home in the industry parlance. I think that's the way we get at it. And that's going to require re-engineering at the patient-physician interface.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Great, thanks. Next.
Hi. I think like the core of your argument is keeping healthy people healthy and continuing on, which is great, but how do you also engage people who are already sick or maybe they're not as apt to use certain technologies like Fitbit, et cetera? Yeah. So how do you engage them? How do you get them? How do you maybe monitor their progress so that they're actually making this change and improving and driving that behavior?
So we're doing a bunch of very interesting things in this space. One of the most expensive patients we have in our company today is a congestive heart failure patient. Water builds up and around their heart, and they end up getting their heart becomes the heart can't beat well, and they begin getting lack of oxygen. They get very, very sick. The best thing, the most important thing for those patients is to keep their water weight down. So when they discharge, we've been done some experiments with Bluetooth technology inside of scales. And all we say to those individuals is, excuse me, when you get up in the morning, stand on the scale. That sends a weight to one of our nursing units. The nurses measure the weight progress over time, and if it goes out of parameter, we send a nurse to the patient's home. They evaluate whether or not the patient's taking their medications. If they are, we call the doctor to get the patient's medications adjusted, and on the way out the door, lift up the rugs off the floor and get them out of the way because patients shuffle when they carry water weight, and they'll trip and fall and break a hip. Those admissions are almost $100,000 for us on a congestive heart failure admission, so it's worth it for us to make the investment in the technology and the nurse to go back to the house. Another case we've done is with Coumadin patients. Coumadin is blood thinner. And for those of you that are interested, it's actually the same ingredient as rat poison. They actually have rats bleed to death is how they use it.
So just to be clear, Aetna is paying for rat poison.
Yes.
Isn't paying for gym memberships.
No, we're paying for Coumadin. Nice. She's great, isn't she? We have a contest where people get enrolled in a daily $100 lottery if they open that pill box at the right point in time, which then we're assuming they're taking the pill, because that's what we need to do for compliance. So we're doing a lot of those things in technology. We haven't come up with the suite of technologies yet, but one of the areas we think this could be a huge product offering is in the senior care market, where people are in the sandwich generation, kids in one place, parents in another, living in another, and they want to keep monitoring, is mom and dad up? Are mom and dad up? Have they taken their meds? You know, where are they in the house? Are they secure? All those sorts of things. But technology is definitely being focused on that today, but nobody's come up with the whole bundle yet.
Yeah, for those that don't know, I mean, in this area, there's just incredible technology that, you know, I get pitched on all the time. As Mark says, it's point technology. It solves one thing, but there's, you know, a pill bottle that works on AT&T's network and, you know, literally sends a message when it's been opened, and you can take action if it hasn't. I want to take just a second. We will get to all the questions, but I want to take a second and look at this chronic illness population, because it's huge and it's growing.
Right.
Diabetes, those kinds of things. Where are we in terms of the scale of technology actually starting to make a difference? Is it yet making a difference and turning the corner, or is it still promising things like these pill bottles, but not yet?
So the problem with diabetes really relates back to obesity and this insidious thing that some people have, a lot of people have, don't know they have it, which is called metabolic syndrome, which is pre-diabetes condition, which is your fasting glucose is over 100. You have pre-diabetes, which means you have a 60% chance of getting diabetes. And it's around diet and exercise. And most people, you know, initially get religion when they get diagnosed with diabetes because they realize this is a real big problem. And, you know, we can get them engaged in diabetes disease management. By then, it's kind of late. But we can still have some impact with a lot of people. The issue we got when we look back at obesity is really diet and what people eat every day. And we haven't come up with an app yet. I don't think you saw that commercial where the guy hired the three neighborhood girls to say, you know, gross, every time he picks up something he shouldn't be eating. And we haven't come up with that app yet. But there are a lot of apps out there that help people manage their diet. But that is where we need to get to, is back to the food supply. And so we're trying a number of things. One thing we're trying through our foundation is we're supporting a program where when people use food stamps at the grocery store to buy healthy food, we will give them an equal amount of coupons to a local farmer's market to get that much more healthy food as a way to encourage eating healthy food, going all the way back, and to encourage the development of farmers markets, which is a whole sustainability thing that we're very interested in as a company. But we have not yet cracked that code. Diabetes continues to be a significant problem. When we look at our population, 34% of our population that we cover, and that's 37 million individuals in various different places, has a chronic disease. That 34% drives 62% of the $64 billion worth of healthcare costs we spend every year as a company. And more than half of that chronic disease is related to body weight. So, and that is growing fast. And, you know, I mean, I have all sorts of speeches. I have the put the cookie down speech. You know, I have all these other sorts of things. But, you know, that is our single biggest issue, and we have not yet crack that issue.
So the bigger long-term issue is how do we avoid the avoidable chronic disease, but technology is also having an impact in how do we manage the chronic disease we have.
Right.
There's some really interesting stuff. So a big part of diabetes management is, you know, right now, you know, people come in with these really insidious problems to the doctor, whereas there's not a good way of checking in on what they're doing.
Right.
I want to get to the questions, but can you talk a little bit about how you guys and the industry is starting to change that relationship so that chronic care gets better chronic care management?
I mean, you know, it's Bluetooth technology in the home. It's, you know, providing some of these things for free. You know, on post-coronary, post-heart attack patients, we now give beta-blocker statin, aspirin for free. We still don't get more than 2/3 compliance with it. Even though we give the medication away for free. So the whole issue, we try a lot of different things because everybody, again, is different. And we're trying to use as much technology, and we're looking at all the new technology out there to monitor it, including, you know, these health hero, health buddy kind of things that look at metabolic use and consumption. on an ongoing basis to educate people.
Great.
Thank you.
My name is Eric. I'm from the Netherlands. I'm a urologist. Thank you for this very interesting presentation. But I would just want to ask, I made an app which measures your voiding pattern, so pretty much your fluid balance. Do you think that doing something like sharing this in gamification is possible on such private issues as well?
I think definitely so. And I'm a kidney donor, so I know all about the importance of fluid intake and output and measuring it. And that would be a cool thing for me to have. I think we'd love to look at something like that and be interested in knowing how you're using it.
Might I suggest some sort of private community?
Yes.
It's bad enough that I find out every time Dennis steps on the scale. I really don't want to know when he goes number one or number two.
400 cc's today, yeah.
But your family members might feel differently. They might actually want that information.
You start when you're kids. You get applauded when you go use the...
It's true.
Potty,
and they
right?
do have apps for that. My partner is a nanny, and they have virtual stickers for when you get potty.
Why should it stop when? Why should the appreciation stop when you're adult?
Next question.
Well, can I add one more thing?
Please.
I mean, if you look at the amount of women that have incontinence problems, in 2006, it meant $2.4 billion in waste of incontinence pad material. So there is a big economic thing there as well. So if you would have a little app that could change that, in which the three parties, like doctors, patients, and insurance companies can work together, that would be a major advantage.
That's great.
And I think
do you have one?
It's actually launched here. It's called IP Voiding Diary. You'll find it.
Okay, good. All right.
So everyone has something they can take home from this. I mean, it does get it. I think these social communities, they are going to vary by thing. I mean, there are things that we can share publicly that we want to share. And there's also using the benefit of all this technology to create the right social network. And sometimes that social network is just an elderly parent and their children being able to connect. Sometimes it's the patient, their healthcare provider. Right. Sometimes it's a community of people disparate, suffering from a disease, having community. My sense is that part of the right social networking around healthcare is making sure they're the right people being connected.
I agree. And so a lot of what we spend our time on, particularly given because we're using very private data, is how we encrypt our capabilities and permission access to that. And so, I see a time when electronic medical records will be nothing more than a master patient identifier, a master physician identifier, going into the cloud, scraping whatever information through permission of what's available in any system, and pulling it into a graphical user interface that's defined by the user to screen out only what they want, throw the rest away, destroy it, and use that information. I would argue that information stored everywhere or all over the place is far better and more safe than information stored in one data warehouse. And yet we build all of this data protection around trying to get it all in one place. I think that's crazy. Let's put it wherever it is, and let's use the cloud to go get it through permissioning. And then what we use is node real-time encryption for each of our nodes, which is every access point to the network on our health information exchange at Medicity. That creates really good security, and it's really hard to hack.
One of the interesting things, though, is we're pretty much pre-big-scale health record leakout, right? We have all these, you hear about, somebody looked up a celebrity's record, and that sort of thing can happen today. But as little as people are using electronic health records today, there hasn't been some huge scare, at least I'm not aware of one, that really changed people's behavior. So we haven't even gotten the positive yet. How worried are you about that first big breach and how much that will set things back?
Well, obviously you've got a whole sector of the regulatory environment and the governmental environment that wants to shut all this down, which I think would be a massive mistake. So what we need to do is, like I just described, use different kinds of capabilities to allow for that breach potentiality to be as small as possible. But we're going to have one. And when we have one, how we deal with it is going to say more about us as a society. I would argue that, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, I'm all over the place on the social media. I'm not quite sure people are concerned about their privacy at all. when I look out there. But by the way, we've had all that data on all these individuals for a long, long time, and we haven't used it for bad use. We've only used it to help. So I think people, as long as you can show them that it's going to be used for good, that it's going to be used to help them, and that it's well protected, I think we're going to be fine.
Great.
Hi, Mark. It's Nate. I'm in the entrepreneurial space of virtual learning from Atlanta. And I love what you're doing with the holistic integrated approach where you have the yoga, the meditation, cranial sacral. And I'm wondering how much you've explored, because there's a lot of top experts across the country in these areas, how much you've explored bringing them in virtually through video conferencing and things like that so that your employees have access to these people, as well as corporate wellness programs and some of the people that you contract with.
So we actually just, in the study we just completed, we had our employees self-identify on both coasts their stress level. And interestingly enough, stress levels were in the top three on both coasts of the country. Interestingly enough, the West Coast had higher stress than the East. I couldn't understand. It must have rained that day when we were measuring it or something. But we looked at stress, and then we said to these populations, we're going to put you into three kinds of modalities. A mindfulness class with an instructor, a mindfulness class online, virtually, and then a yoga class with an instructor. And it was interesting, on the mindfulness part of things, we didn't find any real difference between the online class and the instructor-led class, but yoga really requires somebody to be in the room to help people because you're doing some potentially dangerous things. So our issue on mindfulness is how quickly can we scale it? On our yoga, it's how can we scale it to get it to people? Because the program worked, the reductions in stress were dramatic, even by our own biostatisticians. We found a lot of return on that. We've shared it with our large customers, and they're all investigating how we can move forward. And the impacts on chronic pain, the impacts on acute pain, on flexibility, just breathing and feeling well, were really incredible. So we are looking at that, and we investigate both all modalities, virtual, face-to-face, printed.
What about for healthcare itself? Are there either countries or types of healthcare visits where you guys reimburse standard for a video conference or that kind of healthcare?
We are investigating some of that. I would argue that in China and in India, the only way they're going to ever get quaternary tertiary care is through remote medicine initially, because they just can't even scale their primary care quick enough.
Great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, I completely agree with you that we need to make it easier for individuals to measure and monitor their own health. And I think companies like Fitbit and Zio and others and Withings are in this quantified self movement are taking away the hassle of writing things down and helping me sort of magically see this through data visualization in a pie chart of how sedentary my day is. And causing me to make changes one step at a time. So I also think it's great that Aetna's allowing me access to my...
We only have about 2 minutes, so if
okay,
you can get to the
access
question.
To my information and helping me schedule things. My question is, as for both current Aetna members and, in my case, a former Aetna member, what are my rights and what are your views on being able to pull down my data and pull it into either a personal data vault or some other area for safekeeping, for future reference, and to perform my own analytics on it?
So today, an Aetna member's data is completely available to them and by their permission to their physician, and they can move it to Microsoft Health Vault anytime they want.
Can they move it after they're no longer a member?
As long as we still have them on board, yes, and we do. So it's completely, we gave up the ghost on the data's our data a long time ago. It was just a matter of when we could get it into enough shape and make it secure enough to allow individuals to move it around. And they now can move it around. They've been able to move it around for 3 years, actually.
And do they have other choices other than Health Vault, or is that it?
It's Health Vault or another carrier that they designate.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you.
Really quickly, we want to try and get both these questions real quick.
My name is Raghu. Mark, thank you for your innovative thoughts. My question is more on, given that we are a tech community and a startup community, how much of your revenue are you putting aside for startups like us?
Yep.
Because we find it very difficult to go into this massive healthcare ecosystem with big companies like yours. I don't know how to get in and get some of the investment.
We made $1.6 billion worth of acquisitions in 2011, of which almost $650 million of it was in the tech space.
Okay.
Actually, probably a little bit more. We spend $400 million a year as a company doing new application development, which we are more than happy to do with you instead of having to do it. And with our Medicity iNext platform, which is our provider app store, and with our new CarePass platform, we'll be releasing the software development kits into the public domain over the next few months so you can all write apps that you can offer on our platform. Because we believe it's up to you guys to develop the apps, not just us.
I understand. It's our responsibility. But a lot of time in healthcare industry.
We are out of time, and I want to get...
Yes.
The one person behind you is waiting, so I want to let them ask.
Just a follow-up. The biggest problem I have is companies like Aetna says we'll only work with the big players, not with small guys.
No, we don't. Believe you me, we're working with all the small players.
Okay, really
quickly. You have an app, we'll take it.
As quickly as I can. Two of the biggest diet and fitness apps, MyFitnessPal and Lose It, both claim that people that diet and fitness with other users lose up to 3 times more weight.
Right.
You mentioned earlier that you're conducting user behavior studies. Are these also addressing social accountability and what would incentivize someone to diet with somebody else? Or
I think the people that choose to work in groups on losing weight, like Weight Watchers or these apps, are self-selecting as wanting to work in groups. I think if you were to take a study of putting everybody in there and saying you can have access to this, the problem is that the people who won't work in groups or be competitive within groups are self-selecting out before they even begin. So I would argue there is a percent of the population. I think the last numbers I saw was 35% of the population will actually behave that way because they'll do it in groups. About 25% of the population will actually do it on their own because they get it. And then you got the remaining 45% that are killing us, right? Or 40% that are killing us. And that's the group we're trying to get at.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there's a million more things we could talk about healthcare and technology. I want to thank you guys for listening. Mark, thanks for a great wide-ranging talk.
Okay, thank you, Ina.
Thanks a lot.